I'm thankful for the chance to share this morning. I've got 10 years of research in my head that I'm going to try to compress to 45 minutes. So my prayer is just that I would be able to share the heart of what I've learned and communicate it clearly. Just to give you a few brief backgrounds on why I got into studying this life of Francis Scott Key. About 10 years ago, we were in another church, and I came across this hymn. It's in the Trinity hymnal. Most of you hopefully have a copy or can share with somebody, which we'll sing at the end. And I'd always heard that, you know, all the founding fathers were Christians. You know, we hear that. You know, so many of them were Christians. And I kind of take that with a grain of salt because we know in any generation, God usually has a remnant, and it's not everybody that's Christian. But when I read the theology in this hymn, and I'd heard he was a Christian, but when I read the theology in this hymn, I was blown away by his understanding of grace and the gospel in his own life. And I just really wanted to learn more about him. So with that, I will get started. Francis Scott Key, most of you may hopefully know, he's sort of a local person. He wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, and that's what most people know about him. And that's probably about as much as I knew about him when I got started. But the more I got into his life, the more amazing of he didn't live an amazing life, but he went through a lot of trials and troubles, and God used him in some significant ways in his own little world. And I think there's lessons for us to learn as well from his life. His family came to this country in the early 1600s. His great-grandfather was a very wealthy man down in southern Maryland. And his father became a clerk in the county court in Cecil County. They kind of moved a lot around through Maryland. And eventually, his father settled out near Frederick, Maryland, about 20 miles, 20 minutes northeast of Frederick, along near a small town called Tawnytown. And that's where he grew up. He was very privileged to have beautiful scenery. This is pretty much what he saw at his front door. You know, this is in the small town of Keysville today at the cemetery. I sat up there one winter day and just kind of thought about his life, envisioned what he grew up seeing. And he was a romantic, not as a ladies man, but as a romantic. In him, it wasn't just nuts and bolts and math in life. It was he saw beauty, he saw things that he wanted to create, and he did that. He wrote a lot of poetry. Usually, wasn't that good. He kind of got lucky with the Star-Spangled Banner, people even today complain about that somewhat. But anyway, this is some of the background to his life. You know, just some of the beautiful scenery he had to grow up with. The house he was born in, it blew down in a storm shortly after he died, and then this house sits today. It was rebuilt on that same foundation in 1855. The homestead was called Terra Rubra, which means red earth. There's a lot of red soil up in that area of the country. But to them, the small little stream that flowed by the house was called Pipe Creek. And to them, Pipe Creek became the nickname for their home place. And it was a very special place for him throughout his whole life, and even to the point of his death. A little bit about his parents. His father was a planter, a slave owner in that part of Maryland. He served as the county, one of the circuit judges for that part of the country. His father was a soldier of the Revolutionary War, fought for the American side. His father had one brother who fought for the British side. And both of these men would have an influence on his life later on as he grew up. His father and his uncle, neither of them really that I can see, had any kind of spiritual vitality to their lives. They're kind of a blank slate when it comes to spiritual things. But his mother, on the other hand, was a very godly influence on his life. And although her efforts didn't sink in right away, years later he became very grateful for what she had done in his life. He had one sister named Anna. She married a man named Roger Brooke Tawney. If you know a little bit about history, there's a famous decision before the Civil War called the Dred Scott decision, which had a very negative influence on the issue of slavery and in some ways precipitated the Civil War. And Roger Brooke Tawney was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court when that was handed down. So he was sort of well-connected to politics in Maryland. So he grew up in this idyllic situation, lots of farmland around, lots of farm fields, beautiful view where he grew up, in a home with a godly mother and a kind of a blank slate father, maybe like Timothy in the Bible. But at the age of 10, he was sent away to Annapolis, 80 miles away, to go to St. John's College. That was a big shock for him. You know, he'd lived in a very rural place, and now he's going to Annapolis. Annapolis at the time was the high center of society in Maryland and even beat out Philadelphia and some of the other big cities. People came over from England, and they couldn't believe what kind of lifestyle and society life there was in the colonies when they came to Annapolis. So at the age of 10, he's separated from mom and dad. He's 80 miles away, no telephone, no email, no, you know, any of that stuff. And he's just pulled out of that godly environment with his mom and put in this school. The school is a non-sectarian religious. You know, you had to, the professors had to believe in God. They had to believe some basic things about Christianity. But if you read some of the early texts, you know, they would pray before a meal, but they made sure they didn't say anything to offend the Catholics or the Lutherans or whoever might be in the area. So it was a weak Christianity that surrounded him there at St. John's. And one of the difficulties in St. John's when he was there was his exposure to lots of different things. There's lots of parties, lots of theater there, and he really got caught up in that. His parents were well-to-do. His father lived in debt, but he still managed to get by with, you know, having the good lifestyle. And he was kind of a jokester. One of his classmates later said, you know, one of the highlights of the school year was watching him ride a cow around the college green there. He graduated at the age of 17 with his Bachelor of Arts degree and was kind of a party guy for the next 5 years. He stayed in Annapolis, worked with his uncle, who was a lawyer by that time. He, in spite of being exiled from the United States for having fought against us, he was later welcomed back to Maryland and became a congressman for Maryland. And so he was a very influential guy. He was a lawyer, and he was highly influential in Key's own life and developing his own law business. Graduates, so he's 5 years now. He's a single guy, 17, in big party, I wouldn't say party town, but, you know, there's any pleasure you wanted, you could find there in Annapolis. Lots of wealthy people, lots of dinner parties and things like that. Stays there for 5 years, gets his Master of Arts degree. In that short period of time, he meets a lady named Mary Lloyd. She's probably from the most wealthy family in the state of Maryland at the time. She grows up on the Eastern Shore. I kind of want to hit the highlights of his life and go back and drill down on a couple of these points a little bit later. So meets Mary in 1800, or thereabouts. He gets married. They move to Frederick for a few years. He gets his law degree, business started up there. Then he moves down to Georgetown, which is pretty much where he's going to spend the rest of his life. Georgetown at the time, it still exists, is a small little town on the Potomac River down near D.C. Since that time, D.C. has kind of swallowed it up, and it's all one big metropolitan area. But at the time, Georgetown was the society place for that area of the country. D.C., you know, had just become the nation's capital. It was built on a swamp, mosquito-infested, muddy. If the roads weren't dusty, they were muddy. You know, it was just very, everybody, when the British would come over, the British ambassador came over and couldn't believe that this was the capital of the United States. It was just a rundown dump. And so everybody lived in Georgetown. If they had to do work, they'd go to, you know, to take their carriage over to D.C. to do their business and all. So he gets his business established there and begins his life. By the early age of about 28, he's already arguing cases in front of the Supreme Court. Because travel was difficult back then, you didn't have high-power lawyers flying in from California to argue court cases in front of the Supreme Court. It was the local guys that did it. He was a talented lawyer, so he began to argue these cases. And in the span of his lifetime, he argued over 200 cases in front of the Supreme Court. So he's becoming well-known in D.C., and 1813 or thereabouts, 1812 really, we declare war on England. And this is where everybody knows a little bit about him. This is what they know about him. But I was going to set the stage for that a little bit, because he lived through some trying times that we face in our own country today. In 1812, Britain was at war with France, and Britain needed men for its navy. And so they would just stop random ships on the ocean and say, I think you're a British subject, you're going to come with us, and the rest of your life you're going to be a British sailor. And they weren't too careful about whether the guy was actually British or not. They would often take Americans, and just that was the last their family ever saw of them, because all of a sudden they're in the British Navy. The U.S. didn't appreciate that a whole lot, and tensions sort of grew. The two political parties at the time, the Federalists, the Democrats were kind of, you know, stirring for war. The Federalists didn't want to pull back, and he called it the abominable war. He wasn't into this war. He thought it didn't need to be fought, and he thought it was foolish to get into it. He thought it was fought for political reasons. He said, we could go to peace, but the Democrats don't want peace, and the Federalists aren't going to do anything that makes the Democrats look good, so they're just going to, you know, something like we see today. So we're going to continue to fight this war. He sold his God's judgment on our country for a lot of the trouble that was, the sin that was going on. So for the first year or two of the war, not much action happens in this part of the country. Most of it's up in Canada or somewhere else out in the frontier. But after 1813, the British start to sail their ships up and down the Chesapeake Bay, running random raids. They'll burn a village, they'll burn a town. They burned the city of Havre de Grace. So it was not too far from where we're standing today. There's this stuff going on. And people are really getting jumpy and fearful. You know, what's going to happen next? Francis Scott Key thinks, well, I'm living in Georgetown. You know, D.C.'s the capital. You know, are the British going to come here? His business is starting to slow down because in the middle of war, everything kind of comes to a halt. So he thought, you know, I just would like to just get out of town, go where it's safe, or my house is not going to get burned down or something like that. But I don't want to take the time to read a quote, but he wrote to a friend and he said, you know, Providence has stuck me here at this point in time, and until I see a good reason to actually leave, I think I should just stay and serve God where I am. He wrote that in July of 1814. 2 months later, he would write the Star-Spangled Banner. If he had just felt like going with his gut instinct, he wouldn't even have been anywhere near the circumstances for him to write this story, but he felt due to, you know, God's call on his life, he should stay where he was for the time being. The British come. There's a battle called the Battle of Bladensburg just outside of D.C. Americans are just completely routed, untrained troops, not ready for it. The British march, and they burn the city of Washington, D.C., the White House going up in flames. So, you know, we deal today with threats against our country, with terrorism, things like that. He lived when his house is 3.5 miles from the White House. And I have so much information, but if you could read his letters, the whole country was fearful, terrified. They didn't know what was going to happen. And so they lived through this very trying time, and he lives through the White House being burned, and, you know, obviously can see the flames, doesn't know if his own house is going to get burned. He sent his wife and kids up to Frederick, and he stayed nearby. He was actually at the Battle of Bladensburg, part of the American defeat there. And the British win at the battle. They burn Washington and try to burn all the public buildings down. But providentially, God sends a big thunderstorm and a tornado that puts out the fire. The British, you know, don't have shelter for this stuff, and they march their troops back to the bay, and that was the Battle of Washington. On their way back to the Chesapeake Bay, some of the British soldiers kind of they become thieves. You know, they start to loot houses and just really cause problems. And so an old family friend named William Beans is a doctor in the Upper Marlboro area. He and a couple local citizens arrest some of these British soldiers for wreaking havoc on the population. And once the British Admiral finds out about that, he's not real impressed with, you know, American citizens arresting British soldiers. So he goes and arrests William Beans, puts him on a British ship. And people come and say to Key, well, you're a good lawyer, you're a negotiator. Would you go to the British and try to get this guy released? So here he, sort of trepidatiously, he doesn't know where the British fleet is, doesn't know what he's supposed to be doing, and he doesn't know what's going to happen to him when he gets there. They've arrested Beans, they could just as easily lock him up and keep him too. But, you know, this is what he felt was his responsibility, and he went with it. For 2 weeks, he disappears. His family doesn't know where he is. They know he was going to try to meet the British, but that was all he knew. He gets to the British as they're sailing up to attack Baltimore, and just before the Battle of Baltimore, they take him on the ship, and they say, okay, well, we'll listen to you. Well, we've gotten some good reports. Dr. Beans was real helpful to some wounded British soldiers, so in light of that, we'll let him go, but because you know we're going to attack Baltimore, we're not going to let you go until after the battle. So that's why he's on a British ship while they're shelling Baltimore. And this is a somewhat famous picture. You can't really see. It's kind of faded. But off to the left, you can see the American flag flying. So he's on the ship all night long being bombarded, well aware that many of the people in Baltimore were one of the hotbeds that wanted the war to happen. So he's not all that sad to see Baltimore get shelled himself, but still hopeful that the British won't be victorious. In the morning, he's able to see by the dawn's early light that the flag's still there. And for various reasons, the British don't take the fort, they sail out of the bay, and that's the end sort of thing of the battle. So that's where he gets his notoriety. He has an old letter in his pocket. He writes the Star-Spangled Banner, chains of events. It becomes very popular very quickly, and his name becomes even more well-known, not just in D.C., but in the bigger area. After the war, his business is still struggling. Things aren't going so well. His dad has got debt after debt after debt. He spent all kinds of time in debtor's prison. And the family farm, Pipe Creek or Terra Rubra, is up for sale because of his dad's debts. And so he decides, you know, I love this place, I'm going to buy it. So he puts himself in debt to buy the family farm. And then he lives with debt the rest of his own life because of his desire to help his dad out. He reached a crisis at this point in his life. He was very involved in the church, and he was a lay reader, which I'm not a scholar on the Episcopal Church polity, But from what I can understand, if the rector, the leader of the parish wasn't there in a week, then the lay reader, a layman, would go and he would read the service, basically lead the service, be the pastor for the day. And that's he was well-respected in the church, and that's what he would frequently do. He really considered becoming a pastor and leaving his law practice behind. He didn't see that the law was... He's a romantic. He loves imagery. He loves poetry, and that doesn't fit well with being a lawyer sometimes. And so he felt conflicted with this. But for various reasons, one of which is the debt that he'd incurred by buying the family farm, he felt like he shouldn't just... Well, I'm going to be a lawyer now. I'm going to lose my source of income as... Or I'll be a pastor now, lose my source of income as a lawyer, and put my family under a financial burden. So that and other reasons, he never actually did become leave the law profession and join the ministry. But he came close to doing that. In 1817, he went through somewhat of a crisis. He was traveling through Philadelphia. He'd been having some health problems. And some later person, he wrote a letter to one of his friends about what happened, but some later person kind of like black magic marker over it. So we can't read all the details of exactly what it was. But he had to have a surgery. He felt anxious about doing it. He'd been putting off for a while, felt like, I don't want to do this, but I'm in Philadelphia. There's a guy named Dr. Physick in Philadelphia, aptly named for a doctor, who he sees Key and he says, yeah, you're right, you do need this operation. And Key said, well, I'll put it off for later. I really don't want to deal with it. But the more he thought about it, he said, well, I'm on this trip. My family doesn't even know about it. I could have the surgery and be done with it before they're even starting to worry about me, and I really need to go through with this. He goes through with it, and he says, you know, I don't handle pain well, but I trust that, you know, God won't give me more than I can handle. And he does remarkably well, and the surgery doesn't, it lays him up for 4 or 5 weeks, but he's able to handle it. As a result of that surgery, he takes a few minutes or a little while to write a little book called Sacra Privata, which is like basically a sacred diary, a thanksgiving to God for seeing him through that. Because there have been other times in his life when God had spared him from near fatalities, and he hadn't taken the time to thank God for it. And he said, this is my testimony to God, and it's still in print in the Maryland Historical Society, that this is his record of thankfulness to God for preserving his life. He had been, I said earlier, in his younger years, he'd been kind of a wild guy, and he didn't thank God for those earlier years. He was, he said one time, one of the times he'd failed to thank God earlier, the things we do, he's out hunting, and he comes to a fence, sets his gun down. He thinks his gun's loaded. He knows his gun's loaded. His musket down. He sets what he thinks is the butt of the rifle is on the ground, but it's actually the hammer is sitting on the fence. He leans his forehead on the muzzle just to rest himself for a while. And just at the last minute, when he moves his head off, the gun goes off because he realizes that, you know, it was the bottom of the gun wasn't on the ground, but the hammer is actually sitting on the fence. So that, and he said, well, I was oblivious. You know, God preserved my life, and I didn't really take time to thank him. Another time that he records in this diary, he was... he and his wife were out at some late function somewhere, and their servant was supposed to drive him back in their carriage, and he was drunk. And so Key's just really ticked off at the servant, and he's just flying madly through, no headlights or anything, just this twisty road at night, flying madly through the darkness to get back home. They go through the gate to their property, and the hub of the wagon catches the gatepost, and he goes flying over the front of the carriage and lands down right behind the horse's hooves. But the way it all happened and the mechanics of the wagon, the horses were just able to not be able to kick him in the head. And because it was stuck in the post, the carriage couldn't run him over. So that was twice that, you know, God preserved his life. And he said, I failed to thank God for him earlier. You know, I'm not going to forget now. So just some more details into his life. So the 1820s, he was... just a general lawyer in D.C. I can go through court case after court case, boring details. Sometimes he would represent slaves who were trying to get their freedom. Sometimes he would represent masters who were trying to keep their slaves from getting their freedom. So this is another aspect of his life that we deal with. He's a very godly man, but he's in the midst of a slave-owning world. And I'll get into a little bit of that later, how he approached that and what lessons we might think from that. In the 1830s, he's appointed by Andrew Jackson to be the U.S. attorney for the D.C. So he was going to now prosecute all the U.S. cases, anything that happens in the District Court of D.C., he's the prosecutor. You know, if there's a murder on the local level or if there's a federal issue, he's the prosecutor prosecuting these cases. Some of the things he gets to participate in as a result of that was the first attempt at assassination of a U.S. president, a guy who was just a house painter who they think got exposed to too many chemicals in his paint. Over a period of time, kind of went crazy and felt that he started to think he was Richard III of England, and that Andrew Jackson was not giving him the money that was due him And if we got rid of Andrew Jackson, then the vice president might give him the money that they owed me. So they're in the Capitol building for a funeral, and this guy, Richard Lawrence, hides behind one of the pillars with two loaded pistols, you know, single-shot pistols, and, you know, point-blank range tries to shoot Andrew Jackson. Both guns misfire. Neither one. And Andrew Jackson, old Hickory, grabs his cane and starts beating the guy half dead. But anyway, it just happened to be God's providence. It was a damp, wet morning in January, and the powder had gotten wet, and guns didn't go off. But Key prosecutes this. Later on, some guys tried to burn the Treasury building. They had falsified some of their pension papers, and the papers were in the building, so we figured, well, if we burn the building down, we won't get in trouble. And he prosecutes them. Later on, he's sent down to Alabama. There's a crisis between Alabama and the federal government, to the point where they're almost sending federal troops to Alabama, pre-Civil War, so to speak. Being a good negotiator, mediator, Key is sent to Alabama, and is able to bring peace to that part of the country. He also, on a private matter, Sam Houston, another great founding father or predecessor of the U.S., had been accused in the newspapers of libel or something he hadn't done, so he found the guy who had written that and beat him over the head with a cane, too. And this time, Key defended Houston in front of the House of Representatives. After the 1830s, he kind of returned to private practice for about 2 years before he died in 1843, very suddenly. So that's his life in a nutshell. You know, I could go for hours. But I just want to delve into a little bit into his conversion and the amazing providences of his life. He was, as I said, sort of a wild guy in his early years. And in my studies of this, there was a blank. I didn't have any letters, I didn't have any information on his teenage years, his early 20s, just missing. And I just prayed. I said one day, I said, Lord, you know where every piece of information I need that's still in existence, you know where it is. And I can't take the time to explain how, but within a day, I had access to about 10 letters that he'd written from that time period that aren't in existence anywhere else except for these Xeroxes that I have, as far as I'm aware of. But in these letters, it gives us a window into the kind of person he was. And that's what's exciting about that is you see the change that happened after his conversion. He wrote to an old college friend, and I'm just going to read some excerpts. He says, I have, you know, been violently in love for a long time, but one Olivia, which he's using as a pseudonym for just girls in general, she will not satisfy me. I have generally kept up the same number, about half a dozen. So, you know, one girl's not enough. I got to have six or seven to really satisfy my desires and have fun in life. Another time he's writing about one of the professors at the school that he played a trick on. He said, you know, I was never very much attached to Little McGrath, a short little guy. I wrote a letter to him a few days ago signed J. Brown and got a country Negro to carry it up to college to him, in which I requested him to meet me that evening at the Black Horse Tavern because I wanted to be married and offered him $10 as a compensation for his trouble. The little gentleman accordingly hired a horse, put his prayer book in his pocket, and set off. I had, as you may expect, chosen a very bad evening. The roads were very wet and muddy in a good smart rain. He got there around 6, stayed half an hour waiting for the bridegroom, who obviously never showed up, and came home in the dark, dreadfully disappointed. This affair has been the town talk ever since. I don't think anybody suspects me, but I can hardly keep from laughing when I hear myself so poorly treated for treating his reverence so poorly. But I shall not stop here. He is an infernal hypocritical scoundrel, and I will drive him from here if I can. I have a noble scheme in agitation, and when you and Lomax come, I think we will put it in execution. Maybe this guy deserved to be treated that way, but, you know, maybe he didn't. He continues. He wants to go travel somewhere, but he's still working for his uncle at the time. I'd like to go with Uncle Key, but he thinks I'm so idle and worthless, I will not propose to him a goating at any time. So he's kind of a bum and just out there for fun. Later on, he said, I met blank this morning. She grows more beautiful and more engaging the more I become acquainted with her. I see her pretty now often. Then he goes on to say, I desire you will burn this letter. This thing, to me, God's providence, this is exciting. I want you to burn this letter the moment you get it. Here I am reading it today. And never tell any of them what I'm about to tell you. I shouldn't tell it, but it's so good I can't help it. Some time ago, I was at Mrs. Lloyd's, just a local person there. Maria and myself were standing at the door about 9 o'clock at night. A carriage drove to the door, and we decided to travel in the carriage. Maria suggested to me to hide myself under the seat of the carriage. She would call one of her girlfriends in and begin to talk to her. When we got there, of course, he's under the seat of the carriage. Maria asked for Miss Betsy, who came and sat down when they started to talk. They didn't know I was there. Betsy, says Maria, have you heard that we are talk of all over town about our romping in the mud this morning. Now, what they were doing romping in the mud, I'm not sure what that means. But no, Betsy said, well, who told you that we were doing this or that everybody in town knows that we were fooling around in the mud? She said, well, Frank Key told me. She says, well, blank Frank Key. Nobody else saw us but him. I dare say he told us. Blank his little soul. I wish I had him here. I'd give it to him. God blank him, I say. I'll pay it for him if I catch him, et cetera, et cetera. Is he at your house? Well, no, he's under the seat right here, says Maria. I then popped up from under the carriage, which I was very new during because I could hardly contain my laughter any longer. She looked a little foolish for the first two or three times. I saw her afterwards, but she seems to have gotten over it now. Then he says, this is the way these pretty, innocent-looking creatures talk when they're by themselves. So we think that back in the day, teenagers and young adults or whoever were pretty good, pretty conservative kids and all this. But you get a window into the maybe the misrepresentation of history that existed when we look back to what people were living in. This was, to him, this was great. He loved it. This was the world he lived in. And then he says, one last illustration here. I dined yesterday at Belmont. Matilda has gone to Baltimore, and the fascination of her eyes did not prevent my eating a hearty dinner. I have, however, seen her since I returned, and were I to estimate beauty by the Dutch standard, I should say she was handsomer by a great many pounds than when I saw her last. I guess they like their women large in Holland. So anyway, that's the last letter we have. That's 1799. This is a little flavor into what his life was like. So, suddenly, the letters disappear. About 8 years later, he's writing to a relative of his whose father has died, or family relative. And what I want to do is contrast those letters I just read of his pre-Christ years with this letter. He's writing to his relative who's just had the death in the family. This event, my dear George, calls upon you for the most vigorous and persevering exertions. Your family is now without this godly influence. And while your heart is warmed by considering this situation, resolve with a humble hope in God's assistance, piously and faithfully to perform them. You are young and surrounded with the most dangerous temptations. Restraint, self-denial, and an inflexible adherence to duty are not so easy as you may imagine. Nothing but Christianity will give you the victory. Fix the firmest conviction of its truth in your understanding. Study its evidences. Establish its principles in your heart. Keep its most glorious rewards forever in your view. Never suppose that it is enough for you to equal the bulk of professed Christians in your devotion to it. It is inconsistency more stupid even than infidelity to imagine that merely believing, or rather professing to believe, will excuse us before the searcher of all hearts for the defectiveness of our practice and the sinfulness of our lives. As I am a few years before you in life, I would wish you to have the benefit of my experience. Take then my word for it. Until a man becomes seriously and strongly impressed with religious sentiments, until he believes in his heart that Jesus Christ is his Lord and Master, and joins in the earnest and eloquent application of the converted Paul, Lord, what would you have me to do? His course through life will neither be safe nor pleasant. The thousands around you who are careless and indifferent upon the subject may seem happy, but they are not so. I had once no more religious concern than they, and a full as much right to be happy without religion as most of them. My only regret now is that I was so long blinded by my pleasures, my vices, and pursuits, and the examples of others from seeing, admiring, and adoring the marvelous light of the gospel. I hope you, my dear George, will be able to commence a religious life at an earlier period than me, with a resolution less weakened and a heart less polluted. We have both been blessed with mothers of rare and fervent piety, a signal advantage in these degenerate times. We should never be unmindful of it. So, I don't know when he got saved, but something happened in his life. You know, that's not the guy that wrote those other letters 10 years before. And that is what really, I really appreciate about this. He later tells a story of how this amazing, and I think, so that I don't misspeak it, it's a short, another insight into the salvation. And again, his life interests me, but it's the providence of God that I just stand astounded at, and I can't get over. When he was in school, he met a guy named Daniel Murray. He was in St. John's together with him. And Daniel Murray later, they were lifelong friends after that. And he was always impressed with the sincere life that Murray lived, but he never knew the story behind it. He had always thought that Murray was just a nice, good ethical sort of guy. But he said, Murray is writing this on his deathbed. This is like a year before Key himself dies. So Key doesn't know the whole story of his salvation and how God saved him until a year before, just less than a year before he died. God kind of let him see behind the tapestry, so to speak. Murray says to him, "Key, you witness my happy and comfortable state. I can't describe as I'm dying how happy I am, but I owe it to you, though I never told you and you never knew why I was the way I was." He said, "I'll tell you what I never told anyone." This is Murray speaking. "When we first met and you were a little boy, your good mother had taught you a hymn which you used to repeat aloud every night in getting into bed. That hymn made an impression on me that I never lost. Without your knowing it, I learned that hymn by heart, and through that hymn, I became a Christian." And then Key says he had completely forgotten this hymn his mom had even taught him until Murray reminded him as they're in their 60s now. "Here then I saw the true source of all that had so charmed and surprised me in Murray's life. What I had attributed to the impulse of a gentle and noble nature were the fruit of the Spirit, and the excellence that shone forth in his conduct and character was the beauty of holiness. This he acknowledged with all thankfulness and with the deepest humility. Surely God has here shown us some of the doings of his wonder-working hand. A pious mother, my mother, teaches her child a hymn. It makes no impression on his heart and is soon forgotten. But its work is done, and its fruits appear in the heart and life of another. Shall the mother complain that the seed has been blown away from the soil over which she so carefully cast it, and it takes root in another? No, because as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are God's ways higher than our ways, his thoughts than ours. Who will say to him, 'What do you do?' That seed that she planted blew away and took root in another's heart, produced fruits that were then brought back to the spot which her prayers had desired they should bless. Her wayward child had forgotten her instructions, but they had made for him a friend whose influence and counsel and example restrained and strengthened him in the dangerous paths of youth, whose life had taught him how to live, and whose death had now taught him how to die." So do you see what happened there? His mom teaches him a hymn praying that that'll get him saved. He forgets the hymn, but because he's saying this hymn out loud, his friend gets saved. His friend grows up as a godly example, and through the godly example of his friend, he becomes a Christian. You know, so God could have done it the easy way and just saved him when he's five, but you know, the providence of God in his life, just, I'm amazed at. Give me a second while I shuffle. I want to talk a little bit about his family life. I know I can't get it all done. Let me just briefly say a few things. He was involved in many activities in life, involved in the church, like I mentioned earlier, involved in the American Sunday School Union, promoting the development of Sunday schools in the frontier, one of the earliest members of the American Bible Society, a member of what was called the Lancaster School. It was an early idea to provide free education to poor children in the city of D.C. and various other places. Any kind of philanthropy that he could think of, he did. And he was involved in that probably to the point of exclusion of his family. And that was one of the sad lessons we can learn. But he was very generous, gave away much of his income. And so I just want to say a little caveat, but I just want to talk about his family a little bit and some of the troubles he went through. In 1803, his oldest daughter Elizabeth was born. 1827, his youngest son Charles was born. If you do the math, that's 24 years between the oldest and the youngest kids. In between, they had 9 other ones. So that is a challenge in and of itself. Interestingly, to all you homeschool families, us included, 1818, he writes to his friend John Randolph and says, "I've got all my children at home, and I'm trying to be their schoolmaster, but I'm sadly interrupted. I believe teaching 4 or 5 children is full work for any one person, and I often wish I could attend to that alone." So he even took his hand at homeschooling. 1823, he has an 8-year-old son, Edward. And I don't have time to read the whole thing, but in his diary he writes, "On this day, our dear son Edward was suddenly taken from us. At 2 o'clock, his mother called him from his play to go to school. He immediately and cheerfully put up his playthings, said goodbye, and ran off to school. At 4, he didn't come home, but as often stayed out to play for an hour or two, she didn't worry. At 6 or 7, his brother John was told by the little boy who went into the river with him what had happened. They lived right on the Potomac River. He ran to the place, went to the river to dive for him. His distress soon brought a crowd, and his body was found, but he was gone." So he loses an 8-year-old son to drowning, and all of his sons, sadly, almost all the sons, never had any spiritual life in them, except this little boy, Edward. The one that he saw the most promise in was the one that was taken at the age of 8. That was 1823. 13 years later, he's got another son named Daniel. sort of a rebel. And he joins the Navy. He gets court-martialed in the Navy, gets sent back home, gets in a fight with another guy. Nobody can agree as to who challenged who, but they got in a duel. And he doesn't know anything about it until all of a sudden Daniel's body shows up in a carriage outside the front door at the age of 20. He's lost two sons now. He writes to his daughter, who's living in North Carolina. He said, "You've now received your cousin Elizabeth's letter. I couldn't write to you. But my dear, we are all now more composed, and I hope God will bind up our broken hearts and enable us to submit in patience to this most awful dispensation. I need not tell you what a shock it was to us, so sudden and unexpected. I trust we shall endeavor to see, even in this dark and mysterious providence, the chastening hand of our Heavenly Father, and being able to say, 'Thy will be done.' My dear child, I know how deeply you will feel it. Call upon God to comfort and to sustain you, and pray for us all that it may be sanctified to us, that we may look more faithfully to our God and Savior and prepare for a better world." So again, he's a normal guy. I mean, he gets famous for writing the national anthem. He's a big-time lawyer in D.C., but he's a dad who's now lost two sons and has his own troubles. So he writes that letter to Anna in North Carolina in June of 1836. May of 1837, he's got to write another letter to his daughter on the death of his son, John, who died of a sudden illness and not sure what it was. John had showed some promise. He wasn't one of the lazy sons that he'd had. He had become a lawyer, was moving up. He and John had started working in the law business together. And I'm sure his mind was only full of the prospects they would have together as a dad and son working together in the legal profession. But the sickness came on suddenly. And he writes and he says, "I pray that God might sanctify the sickness to John. I feared for too long he'd been devoted to his prospects of worldly happiness and had thought too little of his eternal interests. And I determined I would take the first opportunity of saying something that would lead him to reflect on his situation. And I reproached myself also that in all the times we talked before since he'd moved back here, I'd said so little about the most important and interesting of all subjects, while the world and its concerns was the frequent theme of our conversations." John goes on to say that, or he goes on to say that he had some encouraging comments from John, and he thinks that he was saved. but then, sorry, I lost my page. Anyway, John says on his deathbed, he said, "Well, at least I have the comfort that, you know, I'm going to die with you guys around me, because my two other brothers that died alone. You know, one drowned in the river, the other one died on the dueling ground." So now he's lost three sons, and with each of these, you know, the sadness and the darkness in his heart kind of develops. But that gives him the ability to write this to his niece or to his cousin when she lost a child. "My dear cousin Nellie, it is only saying what is infallibly true and certain, as she will one day know. Now we see through a glass darkly, but when all the hidden ways of God's providence are revealed to us, we shall see and own that he has done all things well." This is not a guy who's trying to comfort somebody. This is a guy who's lost his own kids. "It's only the weakness of our faith that keeps us from now being, in whatever state we are, therewith to be content. If we believed and trusted as we have a right to do, we should always be enabled to say of everything that happens to us, 'It is the Lord. Let him do what seems to him good.' God gives us many helps in this, our weakness of faith. We see around us in the world many and severe sufferings. The child whose life for which we pray, we cannot guard. We must commit that child's life to God, and he sees best to remove it from the evil to come, and take it from scenes of trouble and danger to mansions of rest. How can we complain? What is it then, what is it thus taken that we should pray for, that we may see the child again? 'I shall go to him,' said David, 'but he shall not return to me.'" Just gives you a little flavor into his life. You know, some of the biographies have written on him before saw him as a, you know, blaming God, you know, God's punishing me for my sin, and this is why the sadness happened. But if you're not a Christian, you don't see the joy he has in the midst of these dark providences, and the loss of children, and the loss of some of the other things that he endured in life. and I'm just grateful that all these letters have been passed down, because he lived in a different world, same country, just a little time, not that far removed from us. I want to talk a little bit too on briefly on his involvement with the American Colonization Society, because this was probably the most important thing to him outside of his legal profession and his family. Obviously, we know that slavery was a big problem in the early part of our country, and there were different ways and ideas for how do we deal with the situation. Many people didn't see a problem with it at all. They thought slavery, well, and we just happen to be in charge, so we'll take advantage of it. Other people, the abolitionists, said, you know, we need to completely get rid of it. And then you had people in the middle who said, well, if we completely get rid of it right away, we're going to ruin the economy. We're going to create a lot of what happened after the Civil War. And so you had Christians on both sides, and Christians who are surrounded by the culture and the context in which they live. And it might be easy for us to look back and say, well, obviously they were wrong. But I don't doubt that in 100 years they're going to say the same thing about us on certain issues that we didn't stand strongly on. So he takes the position of this idea of colonization, where, you know, people were taken from Africa against their will, so why not give them the chance to go back to Africa if they choose to? Nobody was forced to go. The abolitionists didn't like this. They saw that as a compromise. They said, well, what's wrong with leaving African people here? I mean, it's a free country. Let them live and grow here. For various reasons, he and many other people at the time thought the best thing to do was to give them a chance to go back to Africa. And through the work of the American Colonization Society is where the country of Liberia has since grown and developed. Over 13,000 former slaves were sent back to Africa. Lots of trouble, lots of complaining, and lots of things were probably done the wrong way. But he invested his life in it because, as he saw it, that was the best thing he could do. He was a slave owner. He didn't free all his slaves. How do you reconcile that? I don't know. He did free some, and he treated them all very well. But even at his death, you know, he passed them on to his wife, his kids, and all this. So that's something we have to wrestle with, you know. But as we learn, many, many godly men didn't see the problem back then. But as a matter of his character, just want to read this briefly. This comes from an abolitionist paper. The abolitionists, you know, they hated the colonization people. They saw them as compromisers. They hated pro-slavery people. But this is what they had to say about Francis Scott Key. This is on the death of a man named William Costin, who was an African man who was a porter in a bank in D.C. for a number of years, well-respected in the community, a free man. And when he died, you know, many people went out to mourn his death and his passing. And again, this is the abolitionist paper writing this. So this is not a friend to anybody who thinks the way Key thought. And they talk about the funeral procession, and they say, with a large family of his own, talking about the man who died, his funeral was attended by an immense concourse of people, anxious to bear their testimony to his worth. Upwards of 70 carriages, several of them filled with white citizens of Washington of the first respectability, followed his remains to the grave. There's the hearse with the casket, 70 carriages with prominent white citizens following the hearse. After the carriages of the white people came a large number of men on horseback, all colored, all African, but one. And that one a sincere and consistent colonizationist, Francis Scott Key. Whatever we may think of the errors of his belief in the colonization scheme, it must be admitted that for a distinguished white citizen of Washington to ride alone among a large number of colored men and doing honor to the memory of a deceased citizen of color evinces an elevation of soul above the meanness of popular prejudice, highly honorable to Mr. Key's profession as a friend of the man of color. He rode alone. So just another insight into the man that he was. You know, he believed in his principles, but he was willing to stand alone and willing to do what he believed in. Just want to read finally an excerpt from some things that were written about him, not at a funeral, but a memorial service that was held in Ohio after his death. With all due respect for the office of the ministry, he respected the official clergy, the leadership of his church. He did not give in to the idea too common and easily adopted by the average church member that they have nothing to do with public exhortation and prayer or with direct efforts for the salvation of souls. Like those early lay disciples who were scattered abroad, the early Christian church, not the apostles, but the church members who were forced out of Jerusalem by persecution, wherever he went, wherever he went, he preached the word. If he happened in the neighborhood of an empty church on the Lord's Day, he was ready to open it and lead the service and hold public worship. And in social meetings for prayer, he was a leading and fervent participant. Although he had the cares of a large family and the weight of a heavy professional business, he found much time to visit the sick, comfort the mourning, confer with the inquiring, warn the careless, stood ever ready at a moment's warning to lift his voice in behalf of any of the great public charities of the day. Should it be asked, how could any one man perform so much labor? We give you the clue to much of it when we say that he was blessed with extraordinary activity of mind as well as vigor of body. When upwards of 60 years of age, his step was so light, quick, and elastic that it was his more rapid walking that was like flying. His memory was remarkable. But this is the key. Whatever his hand found to do, he did it with his might. Did it while other men were doubting whether they should do it or deliberating how they should do it. Men of worldly wisdom, who placed a much higher estimate upon wealth and fame than he did, sometimes blamed him for expending so much time and energy on what they considered mere collateral objects. But they were sowing for time. He was sowing for eternity, where we doubt not he is now reaping. So what I wanted to do, just to close, is to sing this hymn. Hopefully you've gotten a copy of this. Andrew's going to lead it. Tune may not be familiar, but it's four verses long, and it's not that hard, so hopefully we'll pick it up as we go.